So let's talk about this a little bit. We've got the Barnes Hut N-body simulation. You got N bodies here, you can see them. At each step, you compute the force acting on each body from all the other bodies. So for example, in the middle one, you want to compute the force acting on it from all these other bodies. You then use the forces to move the bodies and repeat, and you understand something significant and even profound about how the universe works, okay? And this shows up in all kinds of application domains. So now, how do you actually do this? Well, what you do is you organize the computation, you organize all the little elements here, all the bodies here, into a space subdivision tree which subdivides the geographic space that they're in, okay? So you have internal nodes, and at each internal node, you contain the center of mass for the subtrees. What this lets you do is, instead of computing the force acting on every body by computing the force acting on that body from all other bodies, you can instead approximate the effect of groups of distant bodies by the center of mass of the internal node that contains all of those bodies. Okay? So it's an approximation algorithm. The reason people are motivated to do this is because it takes an n squared algorithm down to an n log n algorithm that lets you run much larger problems. And that people have proved stuff about how much accuracy you lose when you do this. Okay? So here's how the algorithm works. First step, build the tree, use the tree to compute the forces, move the bodies, and repeat. And you can see how using the tree to compute the forces acting on each body is easily, you can easily run that in parallel. You can see how you can move the bodies in parallel easily. You can't repeat in parallel, but if you've got enough bodies, you don't care. So it turns out that building the space subdivision tree in the sequential algorithm doesn't take that much time, but as you as you use the parallel computing to reduce the time for the others, that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and can at the end of the day make you a sequential bottleneck. So what you want to do is you want to run the tree construction algorithm in parallel too. Well, what do? Well, you drop the bodies into the tree from the top, and they percolate down. And you insert the body into the correct position, add internal nodes as necessary, and that's what the algorithm looks like, a very straightforward algorithm. How are we going to do this? Well, we're just going to take our first approach is we take the sequential pre-construction algorithm, and where it says, for all the bodies, insert the body into the tree, we're just going to say, parallel for all the bodies, insert the body into the tree. What do you guys think will happen? Who says, runs just fine? Who says, I'm not too sure, but I think something bad might happen? Well, we got to, okay, good. So, sure enough, you drop the bodies down. Now I'm going to insert all three these three bodies into this node in the tree at the same time, and I get data races, I get corruption, and I get a crash. So we now know what the solution is. We add synchronization. We complicate the program. It's starting to look nasty and hairy and scary, okay? Not like this nice sequential program everybody loves. We add synchronization overhead. We add space overhead. We maybe add a bunch of contention. We maybe add a bunch of deadlock too. This is the standard thing you do, okay? Clearly, I'm not here I wouldn't be talking to you here today if we were going to be doing this. So we're not going to be doing this. What are we going to do? Well, we're going to go back into the sequential program and figure out what we can do. We're going to organize the construction algorithm so that we don't crash. There's a couple of techniques we use to do this. You can see them in the paper. One of the things we do is every time we're about to construct a new part of the tree, we construct it fully and then only link it in at the very end with one write that commits it. There's also arrays involved. We have to come up with some fairly straightforward staging so that if you insert multiple items at the end of the array at the same time, at the end of the day, you don't corrupt the array. So what happens? We drop the trees down into the body. They percolate down the tree. Now, the tree, we're not going to crash, but the insertions might drop nodes or bodies as they interfere. Okay? So we might drop these two guys. Well, we might drop these two guys. Or we might drop these two guys. Or, you know, we might build a new node, come in, and everybody gets inserted just fine, or we get this, or we get that. So now you can see we have options here. Lots of nice options, okay? So now, what's the effect of this? First of all, we always produce a tree that the force computation can use, but the tree may not contain all the bodies. So what that means is, for that force calculation step, you behave as if that body doesn't exist. It doesn't exert a force on any other bodies, okay? So people will tell me you can't do this because you get the wrong result. Well, we've already got an approximate computation. The question isn't, is it right or not? The question is it accurate enough? Okay? So we preserve the integrity, may affect the accuracy. How are we going to evaluate the accuracy effects? Well, here's what we're going to do. Okay? We're going to get three versions. Unsynchronized tree locking, where you lock down, and the update locking, which is some complicated synchronization, scary thing, complex, scary algorithm. See how scary that is? Don't want to look at that, okay? So we need a comparison point. What we're going to do is we're going to come up with some hyper-accurate version. This is the second big idea. First big idea in this talk is don't use synchronization, have the bodies get dropped, accuracy effects are what matter. Second big idea is evaluate the accuracy effects by taking an already approximate algorithm and make it either slightly less approximate or slightly more approximate using legitimate techniques that no one will object to. Okay? Here's what we're going to do is we're going to make this a hyper-accurate version by going deeper into the tree before we use the center of mass approximation. We're getting closer to the ideal version. Okay? You've already accepted the approximation that we're giving you. Now we're giving you an even better approximation. We're going to use that to compare the effect of dropping all these bodies using synchronization, so it's more accurate. So we're going to start with two corresponding configurations.
Some
question. Oh, so, cool.
So just go back one
second.
Slightly. Hyper-accuracy.
Yeah.
So you could say, I'm just trying to understand if this is where you're going. There's kind of symmetry. You say, look, the bar top one already degrades this much from the hyperactive one. And
yep.
We degrade this much from the bar top, or we're within the same noise range that we're doing one.
That is a rationale you could use. And in fact, that is the rationale we started out with when we ran these experiments. We got results that were surprising to us, and you'll see why in a second. Okay? So we start with two corresponding configurations. There's the reference, which is the hyper-accurate, and there's the comparison, which are these three versions here. Okay? We compute the sum of the distances between the corresponding bodies and divide the sum by the distance between the corners of the bounding box. Okay? So the accuracy metric between the hyper-accurate version on all other versions running on all numbers of processors is 1.02% to three significant digits, okay? So I'm not telling you that dropping the synchronization gives you a 1% accuracy degradation, okay? I'm telling you something much better than that. I'm saying dropping the synchronization doesn't affect the accuracy of your approximation to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 significant digits. Okay? So visually, we've got the hyper-accurate way over here, and all these other three guys clustered together in some very tight ball over on the right. Okay? So to put it, okay, so a picture's worth 1,000 words, but some people see visually, some people like them verbally, okay? This is the visual version of the story. And I'll note to you, this is not the scale, right? Because the hyper-accurate version is like way over there outside the room, okay? Here's the version with words. The difference between the hyper-accurate and synchronized version is 2 orders of magnitude larger than the difference between the synchronized and unsynchronized versions, okay? Or changing what this means is changing the center of mass approximation has an accuracy effect 2 orders of magnitude more than the accuracy effect of removing synchronization. All right, now, no talk in computer science is complete without a performance evaluation as well as an accuracy evaluation, which we will do after I take the following question. So hit me there, Emery.
Yeah, how does this depend on the properties of the system? You mentioned you have one giant black hole.
Yep. Oh, I see what you're saying. So what we did was we ran this with randomly distributed, uniformly sized bodies. Okay? Pardon me? Depends on what you view your problem space as comprising. Okay? If you have one huge mass surrounded by a bunch of inconsequential masses. That's what? Yeah, sure, but the solar system's got 9 bodies. You apply this when you got thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of bodies. Now, the Milky Way, you should be fine there, because even though you've got varying sizes, you've got so many stars going on that the accuracy effect of any one of them for one time step is likely to be fairly negligible. Okay? All right, what about the performance evaluation? Well, we implemented these guys, ran them, and that's what the speed-up curves look like. Okay? So now, doesn't look so bad, does it, right? On the other hand, it's like 10%. So let's take a look at this. The tree locking version dies because you get contention at the top, okay? The update locking version scales pretty well, but it's scary, scary, scary because you've got a lock here and you don't know why, and you've got data races here and it's okay, and blah, 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 okay? The unsynchronized version does a little bit better, okay? Now, I'm not going to tell you that this performance benefit is so huge that you want to run the unsynchronized version, Okay? But, so why is this a valuable talk? I could be Mr. 10%. Well, I'm kind of tired of being Mr. 10%. Okay? So let's talk a little bit more about philosophy and things like that. But first, let me get the key technical concepts. Safe approximate synchronized data structures, they look just like standard sequential data structures. I'm going to tell you the reason one of the reasons you want to do this isn't because you're going to run so much better, it's because the code looks so much better and people are going to feel so much better about it. Okay? So the emotional reaction of the programmer is a key element to whether somebody's going to use your stuff. Results show that people will use inferior solutions that they know and trust over superior solutions that they don't know and don't trust. What I'm giving you is a superior solution that you can know and trust. Okay, Emery, you got to give me some more time. The guy's going to ask a question here.
Can you do this safely for arbitrary operators? I'm thinking about, let's say, deletion and query. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That depends on precisely how these things interfere. What you need to do is you need to be sure that every time the query sees the data structure, it sees a consistent data structure. And then if it's going to do something with the data that it accessed, if it's going to like give some piece of data back and then run it, you got to be sure the deletion doesn't trash that piece of data before the guy's done with it.
So it doesn't look like it's going to be that easy to write, right? You have to be quite careful to be, for example, consume after you have read, because somewhere in the middle, it may have been deleted or modified.
So that I'm not denying that may be true, but here's the thing. Once you write it, the code looks gorgeous and you don't see the complexity. So you can trust it.
But it does not work in certain cases, right?
Pardon me?
But it does not work in certain cases because once you delete the word, you don't know what it means. If you're really careful, right? Anyone. But how can you be really careful without doing any synchronization? That's where the carefulness comes in. You end up adding some synchronization.
Yeah, I mean, you hire some smart guy, they write this code, and it works great. Yeah.
So it seems like you replace the hairiness of plotting, which is scary and not the most cool, with the hairiness of figuring out size effects and pre-validation, which is similarly not the most cool.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Now the difficulty is in validation, making sure the combination of this not really safe thing and this not really safe thing is stabilizes as opposed to multiplies.
No, okay, first of all, they're completely safe. Second, well, I can write down a set. I can and have written down a set of logical properties that characterize what you do and don't get out of this algorithm. And you're guaranteed to get those logical properties. They may not be the logical properties that you think you want, but you don't need those logical properties to have the thing work. Okay. So in fact, there's two kinds of properties. There's integrity properties, which is hard logical properties that the program has to have to not crash. There's also accuracy properties, which are how accurate is the result, okay? So in every program prints out something like the accuracy is, and then some number, okay? To a first approximation, you can think of integrity properties as being the program always prints out the answer is. Accuracy is how close that number is to the number that the ideal program would have computed. Okay, so
how much harder is this than block writing? Or easier? What's the, how do you feel this as a software engineering challenge?
So I think tree locking is probably a mindless, easy thing to do, but as you'll see, it gives you horrible performance, right? Once you start having to think hard about what you can and can't lock, at that point you've got to deal with a bunch of more complicated things. You've got to deal with correctness, contention, deadlock. There's a lot more issues you've got to deal with. I got questions galore here, Emery. What do you want me to do? Okay, has everybody read what's on this slide? If not, what you should do is read it while I answer the next question, and then I don't have to talk to it, okay? Okay, so I'll take a question, and then I got one more slide after that. Yeah?
So after you do this verification of code, is there a verifier that you write to ensure that your program, in this?
So you mean, do I do static reasoning to verify that it's true?
Well, static or dynamic, I don't care. I just want to know, how do I know if doing the right thing? Because I might be new at programming in this manner, right? And usually when I'm doing this,
So what I did was I ran it a bunch of times and found out that it was crashing, and then there's this case I can figure it out. So I just ran it a bunch of times, got it until it worked, then tried to come up with some way of reasoning why it worked and carried it through. You could formalize it. I didn't. Probably that's more effort than you really want to do unless you like doing formalization and proofs. In which case, go ahead and do that for the fun of it.
Well, mm-hmm. So I don't think that my crappy unit test
A one in a million data race?
In a reasonably complicated algorithm.
Then why do you care? Oh, sure. But all that's going to be true. But if your data race happens only one in a million times, why do you care? I see. Then you fix it when they complain. Yeah. Too much work, man. I'm interested in this one algorithm, and there's two perspectives. Okay, I think this is a fabulously important question. Okay, and I'll tell you why. Because what this is saying is, look, man, there's a bunch of different ways of doing this. How can you be sure that your way really is going to be give me some benefit and give me some performance? Because I'm ostensibly selling you this idea on performance, although you can see I'm walking away from that with a beautification thing. Okay, here's what I think is important here. What I think is important here is the concept that you don't need to have synchronization, that you can stand with partially corrupted data structures and run your program and make it work. Okay? Now, I'm running this big research group. I got no time. I'm hacking on this in my spare time. If I've got to go out and, you know, run the fast multipole method, evaluate this algorithm, this other algorithm, I ain't going to do it. You're never going to see the result. Okay? So this is why I think this is such an important question, because there, as you know, we were talking about this in lunch today, there is a trend in this field towards requiring people to do more experimental evaluation. I think that is a damaging trend because it's going to limit the research results that people can deliver. Because what it does is, it does something that only a fool would do. What it does is it ups the ante on what it means to be a successful researcher. Okay? Every time someone asks you, well, did you do this other thing that you have to do a good experimental validation, what it means is you're not good enough right here. You've got to be up here. Okay? Why would anyone do that to themselves? I want to be able to be a successful human being and write and just do the Barnes Hut. I don't want to have to do the fast multipole, all this other stuff, yada, 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 run experiments for 3 weeks, then come back, do experiments for 6 months, waste 2 years of my life on this, and at the end of the day, then I get to be a successful human being. Forget it, right? None of that. Yeah, we got more questions. Yep.
To something that we all trust and believe in that does scale excellently is huge. There's a huge dollar.
Yep.
So you're in the middle. It's like, I think what you're proposing, it seems like it'll be easier to deploy something that will scale. Maybe it won't be perfect. If you do have an issue, maybe you can go in here and make it an anti-progressive logic.
Well, I think I agree with a lot of what you say, but let me back off and do it this way. At this stage, what I'm trying to do is explore an interesting idea. Okay, that's what I'm trying to do. Now that I've explored this idea, now the field has a capability. It can choose to explore that capability and use it. I'm not saying this is right for everybody, okay? It can choose to explore that capability and use it, or it can do something else. But the key thing here is that now the field has a new capability, okay? And it's another tool in your toolkit. See what I mean? All right, so here's the last slide. Bigger picture, right? The field here has always traditionally aspired to perfection. When the people who founded the field came in, they encountered a technology where you didn't have things that wore out. You didn't have the phenomenon that it was perfect on the day that you built it, but then because all the metal wore off, it broke. Here, software was going to be, if you got it perfect once, it was perfect forever. An incredibly seductive idea that caused these guys to then go off and aspire to be perfect. And it turns out that a weird thing happened, and that is perfection is increasingly unavailable and not worth the cost that it takes to get, okay? You got huge systems, huge data sets, something's always broken. And it turns out that we are lucky because something else happened. That was, in contrast to what people thought, software really is inherently resilient and malleable if you do a couple of straightforward things to make it so. What this does is it gives you the option to have more mature and productive approaches. You don't have to aspire to perfection anymore. What you should do is aspire to acceptability. Make sure your program has integrity, i.e. doesn't crash. It's even okay for it to crash if it crashes, if that's acceptable in your context. But typically, people don't want their programs to crash. It's got to be accuracy. It's got to be accurate enough, often enough. It doesn't have to give you an accurate enough result all the time, because that's another hard requirement that's difficult, that can be difficult to satisfy. Okay? Take an end-to-end perspective. See what you really want, not focusing in on the middle. And what this does is it opens up new and counterintuitive possibilities, like having data structures that you don't synchronize, where you get drop bodies, but everything's okay in the end. Okay? So, thanks. Yeah, I got one more talk.
So, one more question. If the next speaker would come up in the meantime.
I got to give this next talk?
No, not you.
In the context of the application, the simulations you care about, when you ran this multiple times, do the errors and the inaccuracies that show up in the computation, are they deterministic, or, how much play is there?
They're completely non-deterministic, because they depend on which bodies get dropped and which bodies don't get dropped, which depends on the vagaries of the CPU scheduler, which is, not within the explicit control of anything that I did in these experiments.
So is it reasonable to say, if you're getting such a huge speed up, you can actually run the computation 5 different times, average the results, and probably get a very high-quality estimation, still be faster?
I'm not getting a huge speed up. Right. Here's the thing. When you remove synchronization, all you do is you remove the synchronization overhead, which is not that big in practice. Okay, you still have all the data movement, you still got everything else, you still got the computation to do, okay? So that's why I view this result as being not necessarily compelling from a performance perspective, but interesting from a, hey, there's this cute capability we now have, what can we do with it? Okay?
All right, let's thank Martin again.